Hello and welcome. This is Earth to Air, the podcast brought to you by New Earth Theatre. I'm Kumiko Mendel, and after 12 years as Artistic Director, I'll be stepping down to pursue other creative opportunities. Over the past four episodes in this series, you've heard me discuss my time over the years with the company, but today we are switching up gears and looking to the future. I'll be talking to Eileen Conant, the incoming Artistic Director of New Earth Theatre. We'll be learning more about Eileen and finding out some of her plans for the company. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. Hi, Eileen.
Hi, Kumiko.
Lovely to have you with us, and thank you for joining me today. And congratulations are in order for your new appointment as Artistic Director of New Earth Theatre.
I'm really excited. Thank you so much.
And I'm sure our listeners are going to be really keen to hear about you and about your journey and some of your plans that you have going forward. So perhaps we should just start at the beginning. I know you refer to yourself as a twice migrant and dual heritage nomad. So beginning with that, where were you born? Where did you start life and how did you find your way here to the UK?
It's funny, I'm actually a thrice migrant, but I say twice migrant because basically I was born in America, but I went, before I was 1 year old, I went to Japan and I stayed until I was three. So my first language was Japanese. And then I came to America when I was 3 years old, came back. And then I came to the UK when I was 21. I feel really committed to sort of first generation migrants and that experience. I obviously, as an adult, I've really experienced that here. But I think really it's that witnessing kind of my mother's journey as somebody who came to America when she was 19. Mm. As a non-native English speaker, I think, and just kind of that experience of being split culturally as well, for myself going back to Japan every summer, and you know, just kind of that way that you're sort of navigating multiple realities at once, I really connect with and identify with that.
And so would you say you had a very strong connection with Japan and with family there, as well as, you know, you've been there a lot, many times, probably many more times than me. And in terms of the language as well, that's a big connector.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are ways that it sneaks up on you. I think I actually, as a teenager, probably didn't really really identify with, you know, I thought of myself as pretty American. But then I think as you grow into adulthood and you start to have, especially as you sort of talk to your partner about values and family, and you know, there's certain things that are really intrinsic to the culture that you don't realize how kind of culturally rooted you are in certain things until you sort of come up against the way that everybody else is different. So,
and then of course you had another sort of cultural shift when you came to the UK, which often people say, you know, when you're brought up in America, you expect it to be sort of similar, but actually it's sometimes more of a shock because you're expecting it to be similar.
Yeah, there are a lot of cultural differences between Americans and Brits, I would say, for sure, yeah.
I mean, where do you think you identify most with, or is that a silly question?
That's an interesting question. I think that in a lot of ways, you know, being embedded in a culture is a bit like being a fish in water. You sort of don't notice it until you're out of it or until you come up against something. So I think our own cultural identity is often defined to us in terms of the places where we come up against difference or we really struggle. I think that there are a lot of ways that I'm really, really British now. I only experience that or even notice that about myself when I go back to America and I have it pointed out to me by my American friends. So it's a really interesting thing, this question of culture, because you're always experiencing it kind of in contrast or contradiction to a milieu that doesn't match what, you know, what your internal experience is.
That's a great answer, yeah. I'm also keen to, you know, hear about your, like, what was your first experience with theatre and what brought you into the theatre world?
So that's a great, I mean, you know, when I was 8 years old, I joined a company called the Company of Little ISCs, and we would tour cut down Shakespeare productions of an hour. At 8 years old. And it was like, and I remember it was like the directors of this program, incredible women named Sue Warren and Sue Klo, they had this ethos that the show was completely handled by the performers. So we would be backstage on our own. They'd be in the audience. And I, you know, some of my earliest memories of the show must go on. I was playing Snout the Tinker. So I was the wall in Midsummer's, and I remember the girl who was playing Quince had a vomiting virus. She was 9, I was 8. Mm. And one of my jobs was every single time the fairies went on stage, there were these bells that I had to ring. And I remember ring, and I remember that she needed to throw up, so we had to move the bells. We had to get her to throw up into the box where the bells had been sitting, you know. And I just remember feeling really proud because I found that solution. Here, have the box under the bells. And, you know, our directors were out there, absolutely blissfully unaware that, you know, I think that Lysander was like 12, so he was the one holding her hair back. And I just had to do the bells.
That's amazing, though. Yeah. So he had those sort of that instinct and practicality around you, which you need, obviously, as a director and a stage manager and doing everything, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Wow. But you also sort of performed as well. I mean,
well, that was it. So I was in that troupe until I was a teenager. So I was, you know, I played Hamlet when I was 12. I played Viola. I played all of these things. And so Shakespeare was really, really my lifeblood. So Shakespeare Santa Cruz was the local Shakespeare Repertory Company, and so I did a directing internship there when I was in high school, and I assistant directed a show, and did more performing. I had a friend of mine, Michaela, started a theater company called Velveteen Theater, and so we it was completely teen run, which was complicated in terms of getting a bank account because none of us were 18, but you know, we applied for our own grants and we held our own shows. And then when I went to university, again, I joined the Shakespeare Society there because Wellesley, which is where I went to university, was a women's college. Obviously, everybody in this show was a woman. And so I got to play Prince Hal. I got, you know, so it was that, again, that tradition of like, it didn't matter. Mm. And then I came to London. I did the National Theatre Institute at university, and I came to London, and then I trained in Lecoq Physical Theatre. And so I sort of like, it was like I put hold everything up until my, you know, quote unquote professional life, everything up until I was 21 years old, Shakespeare, Shakespeare, Shakespeare. And then I started making these kind of like mask, puppetry, devised physical theater, which felt really right because it was like responding in a really immediate way to what was happening in the contemporary moment. I did a lot of work, you know, with survivors of war and genocide. I worked in Rwanda, I worked in Lebanon. So devising felt like the right, it didn't feel right to go to Rwanda and go, we're gonna do Hamlet. But like, let's respond to what's happening here.
So would you say that was what brought you to sort of the devised theatre sort of world? Why did you apply to do that kind of training? And was that because of your politics and your interest in working with, communities, disenfranchised communities or communities in conflict areas?
No, I think it was my interest was in going to London. I think it was literally just that. And I remember there was a Watson Fellowship, I think. There was a fellowship for some, you know, for schools in the UK. And so I just started looking there. And because that was it, I really had loved the my Russian movement teacher at the National Theatre Institute. I was really into sort of like the embodied aspect, the performance. And she said, you should look up Lecoq. And I was like, what? And then actually ended up at this, at LISPA, which is a Lecoq school. I almost can't remember if I actively sought out Lecoq schools or if it was just serendipity. It's one of those things, you know, when you're that age, you sort of make these life-changing decisions. No idea how you
just
made them.
Random, but it also goes back to teachers and inspiring teachers as well. Like you've mentioned already, those two that ran that theatre company, you know, is for young people. Children, back in the day, and then you're teaching now, and it is often those encounters and that influence. I mean, would you say there were other influences in your life in terms of the path you've taken?
Theatre making influences.
Yeah, theatre making.
You know, usually my peers more than my kind of mentors, especially right at the beginning of my career, and especially when I came to London. So I was very lucky, I went to LISPA, which no longer exists here. I think it's now in Germany, and I think it's now called Art House Berlin. But Tomas Pratke, who's the pedagogical director, and Amy Russell, who now has her own company called Embodied Poetics, but the two of them had put together this school in London, and it was an international school. And because it was international, the cohort was incredible. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, and those networks, like within the first 5 years of graduating, I was like flown to Mexico to work with people there on like clown and stage combat. And then I was like working in Lebanon, and we didn't have any money. And so what we did was we would raise money for a show, but then instead of paying each other fees, we would pay each other in plane tickets. And then we would sleep on each other's couches. I remember I brought a whole international gaggle to Santa Cruz, California, and I did a show called Jukai with my mother, who's a Japanese taiko drummer. So her taiko drumming group did the sound, and then I had about five of my collaborators from LISPA, and they were all sleeping in like a tent in somebody's backyard for a summer. It was just incredible, you know. But the stuff that we made was so polyvocal, and it was so rooted in so many different cultures, and it was so infused with diversity in the deepest possible sense because of who was making it.
And this was very much the beginnings of your company. When did you, so you ran Theatre Temoir,
mm-hmm.
and you founded it mm-hmm. yourself. And when did that start exactly?
I was living in Toulouse with my partner at the time, and we were doing a show, a farce about the bureaucracy around documentation and undocumented workers. And we were volunteering at the same time in for an organization called CIMAD, which basically helps people who are undocumented navigate navigate the asylum process and this, that, and the other. And because I spoke English, I was in these very high-level conversations around, like, you know, with lawyers and, you know, and that was, it was really eye-opening because I was just a kid at that point. And I think what I really understood from that experience was that without that volunteer time at the CIMAD, that piece borderline would have been a whisper of what it was. We were only able to do something audacious and funny and incisive because we were really connected to the material, because we were living it every day in this volunteer capacity. So that was when I kind of started going, I think in the UK, there's this tendency to kind of go, do your show and then do some engagement around it. And it's like, no, the engagement makes the show. It's mm-hmm. not the other way around. Mm-hmm. And it was really clear for me from that very first show. And I think that's the ethos that I really took into Theatre Temoir going forward.
Mm-hmm. I know I mentioned at the beginning, you refer to yourself as a twice migrant and the dual heritage nomad. And I'm just wondering, you know, how that sort of influenced your work with Theatre Temoir in particular.
Let's rewind. I briefly referenced how I had done some work in places like Rwanda, Lebanon, Gaza, Kashmir. Basically, I was working on The Odyssey with my friends Dory and Will of Grafted Seed Theatre. And it was two people, and we had to do the whole Odyssey. And what we started looking at the contemporary, and this was in about 2008, 2009. We were looking around and realizing that the story of somebody who's fought a war and then takes another 10 years battling monsters in order to reconnect with his wife, that's the PTSD story. So at that moment got really, really sort of integrated and interested in the experience of war and combat and what that specifically was like for soldiers. So off the back of that, I did a fellowship year where I went and worked with ex-soldiers in four different countries. So I worked with, you know, former child combatants in Rwanda. I worked in Lebanon with people from either side of the civil conflict there. So in that period, obviously, I got really interested in trauma and how theater as an embodied form of storytelling is able to talk about trauma in a way that more realistic or naturalistic, even film or, you know, literature can't really access because trauma is so embodied. So there was something about that experience. A lot of the plays that I was doing were kind of flip-flopping in a way, stylistically, between these sort of fantastical inner worlds and then these sort of naturalistic, gritty, cutting-edge, contemporary sort of new writing. So those two styles were often kind of intercalated and kind of, I wouldn't say competing for space, but almost like running in parallel. And it wasn't always clear which was the true storyline, if that makes sense. And so recently I did a PhD, and at the outset the PhD was about trauma. And I defined trauma quite broadly, but I was really interested in precisely this thing around meaning, so meaning making. So when I was in all of the places that I listed and I was working with grown-ups, a lot of them would come to me and be like, I want to do a play about overcoming being in prison or the time I buried somebody in cement, which is horrible things, but like it was all naturalistic stories. The boys in Rwanda came up, one of them, Eric, that's his, not his real name, but that's mm-hmm. the one I've been using, came up to me and he had a fairy tale that he'd written about a kid who arrives back from the war, he has no arms. His family see that he can't work, so they throw him in a river. He gets swallowed by a fish. The fish, you know, swims to another country. It was America in his story. And I was like, oh, it's a bit complicated, but problematic. But let's leave it as that. Gets spit up. And when he's spit up, he has his arms back. and he meets a bus man, and the bus man teaches him, you know, how to fly a plane. And he flies back to his family, and they're like, we want you back. You're rich. You've got arms. And he's like, I don't need you. I'm going to go, you know. So this is the story that they presented to me. And I went, wow, but this is totally ungrounded in terms of, you know, it's not rooted in any reality. But in terms of its ability to synthesize and capture and communicate the experience that you have, the anxiety about being burdensome and you know, the ability to go, I don't need you to accept me. The wounds that you have, being able to heal from your arms growing, the fact that you fly away on your own and you know, all of those things can happen in a fantastical story in a way that they can't happen in a naturalistic story. And so I got really interested in, like, what is meaning? You look at psychoanalysis and they're always like, you need to reframe your trauma within a narrative with new meaning to, you know, make the trauma integrated. And like, what is new meaning, and what are those narratives that can actually reframe trauma? What are they, and can these fantastical narratives do that? What's happening here when we're doing this? That was my starting point. And as I sort of kept investigating this, what I realized was that what I was fundamentally talking about was not trauma. It was about meaning schemas that were conflicted and interacting with each other in different ways. And then looking at my own pieces, what I realized was, and this is where I promise I come back to my point, which is that I was realizing that trauma, fundamentally what I was talking about was schism. So different operating systems that couldn't exist in harmony because they had different ways, you know, different logics or different structures. And for me, as somebody who, you know, grew up in a household with somebody, my mother, who was always navigating what is Eastern, what is Western, are you too Eastern, are you too Western, that all of a sudden East-West became a huge dividing point for me in terms of action systems. And then metaphorically, that East-West divide starts to attach to other concepts like naturalism versus fantastical, grotesque caricature. There were these binaries that existed that were very primal for me, that were about my identity and my negotiation of my own identity and parts of myself that actually didn't talk to each other well, because they actually were fighting. And it was really interesting to apply that lens back to some of my, you know, earlier theater work and go, that's really interesting. When in these pieces of theater do these styles actually work together harmoniously, and when are they actually competing for space? And why has so much of my, I mean, even in this podcast, I've just gone, I spent 21 years doing Shakespeare, and then I spent the next 20 years doing exactly the opposite of Shakespeare. Why, you know, and what is a theater of bringing these worlds into a compassionate kind of collaborative, communicative relationship look like? And I think that's the theater that I'm most excited by. So, you know, when people like take, like, you know, there's a Malaysian artist who I love who takes like ethnic instruments and then makes these crazy techno compilations out of them. It's that idea of like, how do you take past and future? How do you take East and West? How do you take these binaries and make them work together in a way so that the sum is sort of greater than, you know, the total is greater than the sum of its parts? To be honest, my next question was about why you wanted to apply to be artistic director of New Earth Theatre.
That's the answer.
But it feels, yeah.
Yeah.
That's an amazing answer. So actually, I was also curious as to, was that another chapter closing? You've done your Shakespeare, you've done this. Is this going to be your third chapter? But you're going to be bringing that understanding and realisation, in a way, around your own practice to the work for New Earth going forward.
Exactly. And anybody who's navigating multiple cultures is code switching all the time. And cultural integration is something that they've studied. There are people that are more culturally integrated and less. And as an artist, you know, often what we're doing is we're working ourselves out on some level in a way that resonates with the world. And I can imagine that a lot of the people coming through New Earth will also be working with cultural forms and aesthetics that may compete and may collaborate. And it'll be really interesting to guide that process and nurture that process.
Very exciting.
Yeah.
And are you able to give us a sort of a glimpse into some of your thoughts and plans and for the future for the company?
I mean, you know, I'm not in post yet.
This is true. But I know you've gone through a lovely interview process.
Correct, I did say a thing.
Whatever you want to share at this point in time.
I mean, you know, when I look at the incredible legacy of your legacy, Kumiko, and, you know, I just got off the back of
I'm still working as the associate director on My Neighbor Totoro, and you know, we're so proud of that cast, aren't we? And many of them. So I don't want to name names because I'll miss too many. Do you know what I mean? So many of them are your babies. That is a cohort that has been nurtured. The actors, the designers come up through New Earth, every single one of them. And I think that is incredible. I think that's the incredible legacy. I think that there is something about New Earth now as a company kind of getting recognition for the role that... Do you know what I mean? Like, I think that the next big show with a lot of East Asian faces should be a New Earth theatre co-production. It should. Because because otherwise it's just feeding into this this system. So that feels like the next step. And I don't think that I'm the only person kind of asking that question, because I think a lot of people are really interested in change. I think that there's a real incredible goodwill in the sector at the moment. I think that it is starting to manifest in terms of representation on stage. I think that there are deeper structural changes in terms of how organizations are structured and how the money is structured, and how, you know, that is something that it's not even about willingness. It's about it's going to take real critical thinking from everybody to figure out how to make that piece work. And so that's the next big project. And I don't think that's something I'm going to do alone. I think that's going to be with a bunch of other artistic directors and heads of new writing. And do you know what I mean? Like, there will be so many people involved in that conversation.
Yeah, because it was interesting, because someone actually asked me, you know, how long have you known Eileen for? And I was thinking, oh, yes, actually, when did we meet? And I mean, we sort of actually worked together properly for the first time when you were doing play reading for us for Typhoon. I think that was in 2017 Joyce Lee Zen.
Yes.
But before then, I know we'd had conversations and I was very aware of your company. But I really, really felt during the pandemic, I saw you and heard you, you know, and I felt, I don't know if you feel the same, but you sort of like came to the fore, because suddenly there were none of these silos. You'd been working diligently, brilliantly with your own theatre company, you know, a lot of international work with Theatre Témoin. But actually when that time came, you know, when suddenly lots of people were in different rooms and were talking about all sorts of things, that was a fantastic moment where actually it felt like there was a sort of levelling, you know, and it was like the idea is that we build back from that point onwards. And I think that's just what you just said there. That's really exciting that that is what is continuing. And that's what you're going to be doing, you know, in terms of where theatre is now. You know, we didn't know what it was going to look like, you know, a year later after the pandemic, as it were. You know, how things are, we're struggling. And that you can see in a lot of areas, people are trying to go back to what it was before. And we all said we want to build back better. And it's those conversations and that energy and passion that, you know, everyone needs to bring to the table to continue to think and put into place things that we hope will, you know, really allow that sense of equal voices and sense of everyone feeling they've got a space to make their story. I know that sounds very, you know, vague and generalized, but do you know what I mean? In terms of, yeah, just having something that will really support the next generation and create work and build audiences that we know are building. We know we have audiences for our work, and that's been really clear in terms of our own, you know, East and Southeast Asian audiences, as well as a, you know, a larger audience. Our audience base has really shifted over time, which is really exciting, and that's part of that, you know, move for people to really feel they want, they're going to be represented, that their stories will be heard, they have something to say, and people will listen. So that's the work I'm handing to you, which is fantastic. And it needs that, you know, that
small
passion. You know, to continue that.
Yeah.
How do you see New Earth sort of, I know you mentioned the big show, which is, won't happen overnight, obviously, but in terms of what sort of steps will you be doing to get there?
I think that the thing that is a real benefit of an organisation that is fleet of foot and, you know what I mean, is that we can respond quickly and efficiently in terms of how we make new work. I think that it's about figuring out where that dynamism can be, you know, how does that serve us the most? Where does that dynamism serve us? And then I think that there's a path towards re-articulating how new play development happens. I think it's hard because there's so many different things to focus on, and they're all really, really, really valuable. I think that when I look at the sector, and what the sector has and what the sector needs. I think that the sector has done a good job of opening up opportunities to write very British plays to people who were born in Britain, but might be from the global majority. I think that that is a thing our sector has done well in the last 10 years. I don't think our sector has done a very good job of writing not very British plays and opening up a development process that allows for global aesthetics. Mm-hmm. So I think that people who are allowed to come to the British table, that's changed. Mm. The table itself being British has not changed. And I'm really interested in the fact that, you know, my networks are really rooted with Project Europa, with Migrants in Theatre. I'm sure you've heard the statistic, but 46% of people who live in London were not born in the UK.
Mm.
46%. If we had representative theatre in the city, yeah. 46% of what you see should be multilingual, polyvocal, you know, grounded in, but it's, that's not what you're seeing. So, and you know, 46% of leaders of buildings should be born outside the UK. That's not what you're seeing. So it's something I'm championing. I'm really aware of the numbers of, you know, how many Hong Kongers we have in the Totoro cast, like the numbers of people yeah. that are coming in. And I think that that's one of the doors that I'm really passionate about holding open, because it's not something that I see anywhere else in the sector. So that's one. I think that the other one is around global majority companies and agencies. So I think that you look at, you know, absolutely understand this drive to make sure that everybody has equal access to culture. I don't have a position against that at all. I think that there should be culture in every, you know, every postcode in the UK. However, I think that there's a dangerous thing that's happening where global majority-led companies, like all the other companies, are starting to get pushed out of London, and that's not something that makes sense when you look at where our cohort is located. It just doesn't make sense. So it's also being a little bit attuned to that and going, where are the cohorts? Making sure that you're not in a situation where you're chasing systems that have been designed to deal with other problems, and as a result, finding yourself undersubscribed in some places and super oversubscribed in others. So it's complicated. It's a really, really complicated set of conversations. And again, I don't think those conversations can happen in isolation. I think they have to happen in collaboration with Arts Council, with, you know, I think it's, we're going to be talking with Tamasha, we're going to be talking with, like, we're going to be banding together and getting our heads together and not moaning, but like going, how do we solve this? How do we solve this? How do we move forward?
I mean, I'm hoping, you know, with the next election, that's going to be part of the answer. Yes.
More money,
more sympathy, more understanding around what the arts does you know, the value of arts. Yeah. I hear you. It's interesting because, as you say, for the past 10 years, it has been from a sort of quite a British focus. And I suppose that came from a sort of pushback from that sense that we were, that a lot of people were foreigners in a detrimental sort of kind of aspect. Oh, you don't speak our language. You don't understand. You are this. And actually, no, there are people. And then we've had communities here for many, many centuries. But I think also, having worked outside of London and working with communities, there's also, it's really interesting to see those communities sort of come together.
Absolutely.
Having that opportunity to do that and finding that actually, you know, we can be doing things here. Yes. And it doesn't need to be New Earth running it. We can do it, you know. And it's those things have been really exciting. And I think that's also really part of the work, obviously, we've been doing. Yeah. And I think, you know, how that continues.
The value of that is enormous because obviously, you know, the flip side of their, you know, being 6 BC artists in your postcode is that you're completely isolated, and when you're brought together, it's enormous. Yeah. It's absolutely huge. So yeah, I'm not in any way, I don't undervalue that work. I think that work is so important and it's so critical. And I'm so proud of the fact that I get to, you know, keep championing that work. I think it's a broader conversation. I still, you know, haven't figured out the messaging around it. But I think that if you were to go to an organization like the National, and you were to go, because you're in London, really, like 60% of your staff should be global majority, 46% of your staff should be born outside, like it should be like insane numbers. And why is that not happening? And the answer that you always get is, oh, it's a national level organization that represents the nation. And you go, okay, but then if that's the logic, then shouldn't New Earth be based here and be funded like a national level organization for all of the national BC artists? And shouldn't that be the way that that functions as well? So you can't treat one with one yardstick and then treat one with another and always end up with less representation each time.
Yeah, no, that's very true. The news that Indu is going to be running, you know, the national is really exciting, and see what might shift there. Because I haven't actually heard that argument, you know, because we're a national theatre, but that makes sense. I really take your point about focus, because, you know, that's really important as well. When you focus in, and you can really make really strong changes when you focus down onto specific things rather than trying to do everything and maybe not doing it in depth. So those conversations that you're going to be having with other organisations and to really think how, and, you know, why aren't we commanding financial support and investment from the government when we are serving a particular community, which is, well, we don't even know the statistics, and that's the other terrible thing. We don't know the exact statistics of how many of us there are from our communities, but why isn't that being supported at a much higher level? Because historically, global majority of theatre companies have been underfunded, horribly so, and making that shift and change is crucial as well.
Absolutely. And for me, I didn't go into politics. I went into theatre.
Yeah.
So for me, the conversation, when you represent a minority perspective, and I'm really aware, by the way, of my identity and complexity and the fact that I've got all kinds of dominant perspectives and sublimated perspectives within, you know, like I'm a native English speaker right off the bat, that puts me in a majority of some kind. But anytime your perspective is a minority perspective within a specific context, then your art is always going to be political just by virtue of having that perspective. So you don't need to focus on the political conversation. You just need to focus on the aesthetic choice that drives you, you know? So like, really simple things, like when I look back on like the process of creating Totoro, for example, one of the things that I was incredibly passionate about aesthetically was that the singer be a native Japanese singer and that the lyrics, many of them, be in Japanese. And I was really vocal about that. We ended up getting somebody from Japan, so that ended up being a political conversation, because that's quite a big structural decision. And it means that there might have been non-native Japanese speakers who were able to sing it who weren't looked at. Because, so again, that's what I mean when I say it becomes a political decision. But it fundamentally was an aesthetic. It was an aesthetic instinct that then had to become a political decision or conversation. I mean, I didn't get to make the decision, but I was very, very grateful that I was surrounded by people who were willing to listen. So I think that going forward with New Earth, when I talk about how I'm really interested in, you know, I'm interested in the same thing that the art sector as a wider industry is interested in, which is that people are like, what does it mean to have a decolonized aesthetic? You know, what are the rich performance forms that we can draw on? What does it mean to have a different kind? Everybody wants novelty. That's what artists are driven by, is novelty. And we have such a rich heritage here, but it's about how to access that. And part of accessing that, you know, if you're trying to develop a piece that is really culturally rooted in a specific performance form that isn't English language, then that texture is going to have to be brought in a structural way, and how to make that structural thing happen, that's going to be your political conversation. But it's driven by the aesthetic impulse to have that culturally rooted aesthetic.
I'm really excited and looking forward to seeing the work that's going to be coming from New Earth. And I have to say, I'm really delighted that the board have made a fantastic decision. Nothing to do with me, of course. But, you know, congratulations again.
I know that you've been interviewing me, but yeah, I wonder if I could ask you just for like your reflections and your advice going forward, because I'm just aware that you have so much experience, and here I am with my pie in the sky ideas.
You've got really, I feel that you've got very clear ideas, and you have a very good sense of the theatre environment and sector. I mean, advice, I think you have to be, I know this is probably anathema, but you have to be patient, because we all want change. We all want change overnight, and it's always slow, and it is frustratingly slow, but don't give up, you know, because for every step forward, you know, there's so many going back, but I'm a positive person, optimistic. I feel like it's all worth it. Things will shift. Things are shifting. Things have shifted, you know, in really positive ways. And not to let go of that, even though when you sometimes feel like you're banging your head against a brick wall. And that, you know, and seek out your allies, those who, you know, share the same values. There are so many brilliant people working in theatre who are really working for the right thing, have, you know, that similar vision, and they want to make change. And you know those people already. And I'm hoping I'll be able to introduce a few more if you don't know them. So that there's a sense that you have a community around you, because it can be lonely. I think the pandemic did really open things up when those rooms suddenly opened up. People started talking and sharing so much more. Because before then, we were all working in our little, you know, and we sort of have those conversations. We had to seek them out. But this was a much broader opening, I think, and allowed lots of different voices to come in. So, you know, use those. Don't feel you're alone. I know you're a very collaborative person, and that's the way you work, which I think is fantastic, because I always think five heads are better than one.
Yeah.
And, you know, don't feel it's like all on your shoulders.
Yeah.
And you'll lead. Find your own authentic way of leading. You will. I mean, you've already been leading a company, and you know, you adjust to a different team, and you bring in new people as well. And, you know, it's like, I feel like I want to hand it to you, and it's yours.
Yeah.
And you need to do what you need to do with it, you know, alongside working, obviously, with Leanne as co-CEO.
Yeah.
So together, you take that forward. And be brave, which I have no doubt you will be. I know you will. You'll keep your eyes open, you know, and ear to the ground, and just be aware of, but also not to let you get sucked here, sucked there, but have that very clear path that you want to follow.
You talked about how sometimes it felt like banging your head against the wall, and then sometimes there was like a shift. Do you have any moments where you kind of remember like going, like you just remember a shift?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, I suppose, you know, with The Orphan of Zao, which was a really difficult time in so many ways, because, you know, knowing people within the production at the RSC, that was also hard for them. And then, but also, you know, it was for a greater moment in terms of why isn't there better representation? You know, there's more representation of East and Southeast Asian actors within this play.
Mm.
And we had this big open space that was facilitated by Improbable, you know, happened at the Young Vic. And that was a big moment, you know, where so many people came in and so many people felt like, you know, they could say their piece and they could be heard. And that felt like a real moment and a shift.
Mm.
And then I suppose, you know, being able to approach someone like, I suppose, because we run the bursary, and I just dropped an email to Alistair Coomer, who's the head of casting, and he was just like, yes, we're going to support this. Yes, come and do it at the National. Mm. Let's bring in people who are coming through drama school and let's see them. You know, and that's sort of just that very, very open, very accepting, just like, yes, of course, we should be doing this.
Yeah.
Without having to sort of, you know, I suppose it's not, or just not getting an answer, I suppose, you know, it's not getting a reply.
Yeah.
And all those sort of moments, but yeah, I mean, I suppose getting MPO
after trying
for about three rounds
after
we lost regular funding.
Yeah.
That felt like a moment.
That thing about the ease of a meeting, I really feel that. I really sense the way that you have been knocking on doors and knocking on doors and knocking on doors, and then that door is open, and if there are any doors that I get to walk through and have a meeting, it's because of your legacy and the hard work that you've done.
And not just walking through the doors, but people actually genuinely want to listen and they want to understand, they want to learn.
Yeah.
That's really changed.
Yeah, that's huge.
Yeah, well, thank you. I mean, I like to think that's... to do with the work. I mean, I'm sure it is partly absolutely to do with the work, but there's not just me, there's obviously many others. But anyway, for now, thank you so much, Eileen, for a wonderful, wonderful chat. And I wish you all the best. And I'm sure we'll be hearing more from you in the future.
I'm so excited, Kumiko. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Earth to Air. Be sure to check out our other episodes in the series. The Earth to Air podcast was brought to you by New Earth Theatre and presented by the team, edited by Yuinoa Tokumaru, with original music by Nicola T. Chang. Visit our website newearththeatre.org.uk and stay connected with us through our social media channels.